Hello everyone, this is Flo.
And this is Jesse.
Welcome to the now publicly available Great War Channel podcast, where you can now enjoy all our 30-something episodes in our archive, including the Patreon-only episodes that we recorded in the last 2 years, and where we have a very exciting summer ahead of us with plenty of world-class historians that we are going to interview. And what do we have for our listeners today, Jesse?
We have another rock star. I know I'm biased. The First World War is my thing. But nonetheless, we are going to be talking to Dr. Jonathan Boff, who wrote a book about Crown Prince Ruprecht. But it's so much more than that. It's about Germany's conduct of the war on the Western Front. I found out about it just when it came out a couple of years ago. It was recommended by a historian friend of mine in Canada. And it's a really interesting perspective. I think he does a great job of teasing out a lot of the themes that are interesting to me, like the German perspective or comparing the two, or how is the army connected to an individual commander and how's that connected to a society? You know, what are the results of that on the battlefield? These are pretty cool things, right? What do the Germans think about stuff that we kind of already know what the British think about a particular battle? Or this to me was a great read. I've used it again for other projects we've done in the meantime, just recently, for example. So I was quite excited to talk to him.
Yeah, and I think all you out there in internet land will enjoy this interview very much. The book is called Haig's Enemy. It's a very successful book. It has won numerous awards, has been translated into multiple languages. And we are very happy and also a bit proud that Dr. Boff has agreed to be interviewed by us. Some of the questions that we ask are from our Patreons, and this is something that we will do continue in the future, that we will ask our Patreons if they have any questions for the experts in here that we interview. So if you wanna, support our project in general, and if you wanna ask world-renowned historians personal questions about their research topics, you can always do so on Patreon. So your support would be very much appreciated. And now, without further ado, here's the interview with Dr. Boff.
So I'm very happy to be joined today on the podcast by Dr. Jonathan Boff, who's a senior lecturer in modern history at the University of Birmingham, and important for our purposes today, also the author of the book Haig's Enemy, Crown Prince Ruprecht and Germany's War on the Western Front. So, Dr. Boff, thank you very much for joining us today.
It's a great pleasure to be here. Thank you very much indeed.
All right. So we've got a few questions here. Some of them are from our viewers as well. But let's start off general. What drew you to Crown Prince Ruprecht, and why did you get interested in that particular topic, that angle?
Well, two things came together at pretty much the same time. The big thing, if you like, was that I felt pretty strongly that certainly the Anglo-Saxon historiography of the First World War is written very much from a British Commonwealth perspective. There's not an awful lot about the enemy. Indeed, there are many books you could read about the British Army on the Western Front and not even be aware that there were any Germans or any French anywhere near. And so I was looking for a project that would give me a chance to look at the war from both sides of the barbed wire, if you like, and to try and try and help people understand that this was, after all, a war. There were two sides to it. It was a dynamic process that was going on. And at the same time, I was just finishing up a previous book, which had been about the last 100 days of the First World War. And as I was doing research for that, as you will know, the best place to do research, one of the best places to do research into the German army, because of the destruction of the federal records in Potsdam in the closing in 1945, is in the local state military records, and particularly the Munich military records of the Bavarian army. And I was doing research there because Crown Prince Ruprecht was the commander of the forces that the British troops I was primarily writing about were fighting against. And while I was going through some of the records there, I found in you know one of those sort of random files you come across in archives sometimes, which is what makes my job fun, a little like a passport, just a piece of paper giving free transit from Belgium into the Netherlands of the Marquis de Spanish name and his party. And this was dated, I think, 9th of November, 1918. And I thought, this is a funny thing to find in the Bavarian military archives. Why are they here? And when I sort of dug around a little bit more, I found out that it was the Spanish Marquis was actually the Spanish ambassador to Belgium. And he was essentially smuggling Crown Prince Ruprecht into the Netherlands under a false name, Herr Landsberg. To get him out of Belgium and keep him away from the Bolsheviks who were taking over the German military at the time. The Netherlands at the time, as you will know, were neutral. So he was safe there from the Allies and hopefully safe from the German soldiers too. And I thought, well, that's quite an interesting story. You know, here is this general, proud scion of, you know, one of the oldest royal families in Europe, major prop of the imperial regime in Germany before 1914, Crown Prince of Bavaria, and yet he's having to sneak away into overseas disguised as a chauffeur. You know, what happened between those two points? How does a field marshal in the German army end up on the run in Holland? And I thought that sort of that story looked like it had the potential to be an interesting story to tell, and that was why I went off and started doing a lot more research on Ruprecht himself. And luckily, and I'm afraid sometimes you just have to be lucky, particularly if you're not good. It turned out that you know his military career was going to enable me to do what I started off by saying in terms of showing the German side of the story. Of the First World War on the Western Front, the whole way through from beginning to end. So the two things came together in a rather beautiful way.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's actually what I like the most about the book. I have a very strong, similar feeling about the English language historiography that's always bugged me, even in Canada, where, you know, we have another national language. But yeah, I suppose Ruprecht himself was asking some of the same questions as you as he was on his way to Holland. You know, how did I get from point A to point B? As far as the title of the book is concerned, we had a viewer who's wondering about the choice of title because, I mean, the book is clearly centered around Ruprecht and his context on the Western Front. But Haig is the first name in the title.
Yeah. Well, I'm not going to lie to you. Of course, there's a bit of marketing involved in this. It's aimed at a British audience. In Britain, everyone knows who Douglas Haig is. No one would know who Crown Prince Ruprecht was. So I and the publisher spent a long time talking about titles backwards and forwards and so on and so forth. And eventually thought that this was the best we could come up with. Anyway. By the way, of course, it had absolutely zero traction in the United States because they don't know who Douglas Haig is either. But that was my silly mistake. Should have thought about that.
I can imagine, yeah.
Yeah. But to be honest, you know, what else could, if one had called it The General or something like that, it would have been so general that it's very hard to tell really what it was all going to be about. But it's not just marketing, to be fair, I don't think. There is a correspondence here between these two men in the sense that from October 1914 through to November 1918, so all by the last 3 months, the first 3 months of the war, Ruprecht was fighting against the British. He was the main German commander in the British in the sector opposite the British the whole way through. That British sector got bigger, of course, as the war went on. To begin with, there were many more French than British, but nonetheless, he was, if you like, a sort of consistent factor. The supreme commanders changed, Moltke to Falkenhayn to Ludendorff and Hindenburg, The individual army commanders changed, of course, underneath Ruprecht, but he was, if you like, a constant, and he was there the whole time. And you know, I wouldn't pretend, and you can't pretend, that there was any kind of personal rivalry between Douglas Haig and Crown Prince Ruprecht. I think I did count it up. I think in Ruprecht's diary, and one of the reasons he's interesting is because he left a very voluminous diary. So the sources are good, and lots of good letters. In his diary, he does mention Douglas Haig, but only three times in 3 years. And he spells his name wrong twice. Just, you know, it's only a four-letter name. It's not that difficult to spell, right? and Douglas Haig only mentions Ruprecht once or twice in his diaries as well. So, you know, the kind of propaganda, if you like, that particularly during the Second World War, British propaganda loved pitting Montgomery against Rommel and pretending that there was some kind of personal rivalry between these two men, which both of them played up to a little bit, to be fair. You know, that kind of dynamic didn't exist in the First World War. Indeed, both Ruprecht and Haig, I am quite sure, would have thought it was rather vulgar and a bit beneath them to engage in that kind of theatrics. So there was no personal rivalry, but as a matter of fact, they were both doing the same job on opposite sides of the of no man's land. Therefore, I thought, and Haig has been, frankly, obsessively pored over his career by you know, a variety of really good historians, and so there's a very good base of information about what that kind of job looks like on the British side and what Haig did and didn't do in the course of the war. And so this is, if you like, trying to redress the balance a little bit, because the same is not true on the German side. The German historians don't write this kind of history on the whole, or have tended not to. And again, you know, so there are good biographies of Ludendorff and of Hindenburg and of some of these people, of Falkenhayn, but the next level down tends to get overlooked. So I thought that was another gap that I could fill.
So just to emphasize once again to our viewers that this book goes beyond biography. It's not just about Ruprecht himself or his development or his ideas alone. It's in a context. And one of the parts of that context that that you point out is that you write that Ruprecht's career lets us kind of challenge some of the preconceptions about the First World War and even about modernity as an idea. So give us a little, for those of us who haven't read the book yet out there, the listeners, give us a little hint. What are some of these preconceptions that you can challenge by Ruprecht's story?
Sure. Well, I think, again, and this comes back, and thank you for picking up on the fact that it's more than a biography, because it is supposed to be using the biography as a gateway into these broader themes. That's very much what I was trying to achieve. I think some of the preconceptions that you see again in the Anglo sphere about the First World War, I've hinted at a little bit already. Number one, that the British are sort of exceptional in the way that they operate during this war, and particularly in the way that they learn how to get better at fighting modern warfare. So you don't get any sense that the British had allies. And of course, the British were the junior partner in the coalition in France, not the senior partner for most of the time. So I wanted to try one of the things I wanted to point out was how, from a German perspective, Britain was not the number one enemy, at least not military, not on the battlefield. On the battlefield, the number one enemy was the French. And that was who they were more scared of, and that's who they spent more time worrying about how to defeat than the British. Politically, different story, actually, and obviously at sea, completely different story again. But in terms of the problem that was facing the soldiers, it was primarily seen as a French problem, not a British problem. So that's one, perhaps. I'll just give you a few sort of almost random examples. A second one would be, I think most of us, intuitively, when we think about the First World War, we think about two lines of men stuck in muddy trenches for 4 months for 4 years, not going anywhere and not moving anywhere. It looks like a very static, stalemated situation. And of course, in a sense, it was. But it was a stalemate born of a very intense dynamic process of measure and countermeasure, where it just so happened that no one had yet got to the point, at least not until 1918, where they were able to break that stalemate. It wasn't that everyone was just sitting there waiting for something to happen, which I think is a sense that one can sometimes, or actually the sense that one gets from a lot of the literature, is that everyone was just sitting there waiting to die. And that, I think, would be a third preconception that I would want to sort of push against. You know, that's obviously not where most people were coming from most of the time. And then when it comes, and so that leads on to an assumption, perhaps, that that the soldiers of the First World War were victims, that they were on the receiving end, if you like, of industrial, technological changes, political changes, which took away their agency, meant they were completely passive in this process. Well, again, that's not the way they felt about themselves, and that's not what they were trying to achieve. They thought they were doing something worthwhile and were doing it in a worthwhile manner. And when it comes to sort of modernity more broadly, well, I mean, you know, academic historians tie themselves in the most appalling knots about what modernity means. And whether it means anything at all, and if it does, how we can analyze it, and so on. And so I don't sort of want to get into that. But I think it is kind of fair to say that in some sort of general sense, most of us feel that over the last 100 years or so, the world has changed. And it's changed a lot, and it's changed quickly, and it might even be changing quicker every decade than the previous one. Maybe I'm not so sure about that, but anyway, that's the perception. And so one of the issues of history, and this is particularly true of German history, but also of British history as well. So one of the issues that throws up is, to what extent were the problems of Germany in the first half of the 20th century caused by an inability to adapt to the modern world in which it was starting to find itself? And if sadly as it is, the problem of German history in the first half of the 20th century is the problem of European history in the first half of the 20th century, and arguably of a lot of world history in the first half of the 20th century, then that seems to me to be a pretty urgent question to have a look at if you want to understand the 20th century. And so the capacity of the institution, German institutions and German society to respond to all, of course, a whole world of things changing, but the military is a particularly narrow focused, a case study, if you like, of a subset of that change that one can study in a relatively closed off environment, if you like, the battlefield, seemed to me to be a useful exercise to try and to try and pursue.
And that kind of leads me into our next question, which is, on this general topic of German society and its particular characteristics and so on, you talk about how some of the weaknesses of the army reflect some of those characteristics of broader German society. Not that that was a really interesting way of going about it, but I can imagine that's a bit of a slippery argument to make stick. So how did you go about it, and what are some examples of that?
Well, I think the quick answer is that I chickened out of going too far down that road, because it could take you into
volume,
into the depths of German history. Exactly. I mean, I'd be like you know, some of these German historians that write these sort of 3,000-page books and things like that. I haven't got time or energy to do that. But I think, so to come back to the question, so but it does seem to me that there are some themes that I could bring out that mainly that people have brought out in other work. And there were several sort of perhaps three strands to this. The first is that the war, that it's certainly very easy, and particularly easy for non-Germans, to forget what a young country Germany was 1914-1918. Within the lifetime of most of the people that were alive, Germany had not been a single country. Ruprecht was born in 1869, so 2 years before the formation of Germany himself. And everyone in power, more or less, was of that generation or a little bit older. And what had happened, I think, was that a lot of the religious divides, a lot of the regional divides, a lot of the class divisions within German society, some of which were caused by industrialization, some of which were predated the formation of the empire in 1871, largely under Bismarck, Bismarck had largely managed to, in some cases exacerbated them, but nonetheless he'd managed to suppress them. And he had managed to form a single country out of this very diverse, very disparate country. Now, you know, you live there, you know this better than I, much better than I do. But the English people don't see this. They think Germans are Germans. They don't understand the difference between Hamburg and Munich on almost every level of culture and society. And that's in the modern world, right? So how much less must they understand about it 100 years ago? So what you see, I think, with the First World War, or one of the factors in the First World War, is the bubbling up of all these suppressed divisions between different religions, between different classes, between different regions, back up and into becoming live problems, which then burst out in various forms in the November Revolution in 1918 and subsequent events over the next few years as Weimar tries to stabilize itself. And that sort of leads into, I suppose, a second issue, which is the institutions that exist to tie this country together. The army is a particularly interesting one because, as your listeners will know, before 1914, or rather in peacetime, individual German states still maintained their own armies, although they were run on lines. They were aligned with the Prussian system of doing things, and the Kaiser was designated as the supreme overlord in the event of war. So when war was broke out in 1914, the army, if you like, overnight became an imperial institution. But it still had these regional problems, and nowhere was that clearer than with the Bavarians. And as the war goes on, the frictions between Bavarians and Prussians, for instance, within the high command of the German army, start to make themselves felt again and become increasingly problematic as the war goes on. So I think what you and that's symptomatic, and this is the final point I'll make on this, of the fact that Bismarck had created a system which only Bismarck could manage. And as soon as there wasn't a Bismarck, someone with the genius of Bismarck and the sheer deviousness of Bismarck to do so, then the system was already in trouble and needed either reform or another genius. And of course, it didn't have a genius. It had Wilhelm II, very far from a genius, and he didn't have geniuses around him either. And even if he had, he probably wouldn't have known how to use them. So so that's what I mean, I think, by some of these the institutions themselves also not really being fit for purpose in the way they operated. And just to give you one very quick microcosm of that, the German command system, or the command system of the German army itself, I think is, you know, looks very old-fashioned, certainly from a modern perspective and even at the time, in the sense that the influence of the Kaiser was extremely strong over who got the jobs. Who got the good jobs in the German army, and therefore it was still run. You know, the promotion system was not that different from the promotion system that had operated under Frederick the Great. Now that had worked very well for Frederick the Great, but that was a long time. That was a long time ago, and the world was now rather different. And so the inability to reform that and improve it, I think, was an important factor in Germany's defeat.
All right, I can imagine that. Lloyd George might have been slightly envious of the Kaiser's influence over who had what positions in the army. Now, sticking with this army, this partly flawed institution, and let's couple that with this idea of the famous idea of the British learning curve. The British come, they have a mass army for the first time. Most of them don't know what they're doing. Then after the Somme, they learn and play an important role in defeating Germany. That's kind of this, you know, what you hear quite often. But in spite of their flaws, the Germans were also learning. But you emphasize, in contrast to the British learning curve, the deterioration of the performance of the German army. So how did that deterioration end up outweighing the German learning curve and ending in their defeat?
Well, the way I see this is, I think your characterization of the British army is absolutely correct. So the, you know, the small professional BEF that goes to war in 1914 is destroyed to all intents and purposes in the course of 1914. The very few survivors are then spread very thinly across this huge volunteer force, and it takes them a long time to learn how to fight this kind of war again. The Germans are starting from a much higher base. This is, after all, the war for which they have prepared for 50 years. And although, of course, there are bits of it that surprise them in 1914 and 1915, they have a better system and a better overall grasp of what is likely to be required at the beginning of the war. Indeed, the whole military, I would argue, is set up to win a quick war, not to fight the kind of long war that they get dragged into. Now, there are two ways of looking at what goes next. If you believe Ludendorff and a lot of the German generals from their memoirs between the wars, the problem is that the level of German casualties in the first 2 years of the war, particularly in 1916, is so high that this fantastic German Continental Army has been, again, largely destroyed and turned into a citizen militia, which is not as technically skilled and not as motivated as the army of the first half of the war, and that most of the problems of the second half of the war can be put down to that. All those problems that you can't blame on the civilians on the home front anyway. A second way of looking at it is just to say, well, you know, when the British are starting from a very low base, their pace of the slope of their learning curve, if you like, is very steep. The Germans are starting from a higher base and are not so good at learning and adapting on the game. And at some point, those two curves are going to intersect, and that's largely, I think, what happens. So the Germans, as you're absolutely right, they do learn, they do get better at certain aspects. But they also aren't learning fast enough. And particularly in 1918, the Allies, I think, and a large part of this is the material superiority and the manpower superiority of the Allies, they just start asking too many questions of the Germans, of the German high command. And the German high command can't answer them, and nor is it prepared to delegate, or is not capable of delegating to lower levels to solve the problems on their own, if you like. And as a result, it's the brain of the German army, if you like, goes catatonic, and no longer functions, and therefore can't respond to any outside stimulus. Actually, it just sort of, you know,
other than perhaps an obsession with tactics, right?
Right, that's right. They know that they know how to solve tactical problems, and therefore they go out looking for tactical problems to solve rather than actually stepping back and saying, right, what are the real problems that we're facing here? I mean, I'm not going to lie to you. A large part of this, when I was writing this book and thinking about it, a large part of me was thinking about the Americans and the British in Iraq and Afghanistan and the ability of both those militaries to innovate while they were fighting. And I was doing a lot of work with both militaries over the last 10 years or so about these kind of questions. And it struck me that there were some similarities, and that, you know, you could argue for as long as you like about whether you should have patrol houses scattered in villages throughout Afghanistan or have big central bases with guys going off in helicopters to where they were needed when they were needed. But neither of those really identified the real problem, which was that the Afghans didn't want them there and that it wasn't a war that was winnable militarily. And so I suppose at the back of my mind, I was thinking that the British and the Americans were making some of the same mistakes as Ludendorff and Co. had made in 1618.
Wow, that's quite an interesting little bit of context to behind the book. I'll have to reread it now with that in mind. Yes, perhaps for the last question here, one that, again, this idea of perspective that particularly appealed to me. You mentioned that some of the battles that, you know, the British consider very significant, and there's been a lot written about them and so on. Of course, I guess I'm thinking of maybe Neuve-Chapelle and these kinds of things. The Germans, they don't really register them in the same way. They're at best a footnote, I would say. And can you give maybe one or two examples of that difference in perspective and maybe why?
I think Neuve-Chapelle is a very good one. It's a very small scale operation compared with the kind of battles that the Germans and the French have been fighting up until that point. There are other battles in 1915 that would certainly fit into the same category. Festubert, for instance, very well known in Britain. Well, relatively well known in Britain, not known at all in Germany, because it's a disaster. You know, from the German perspective, it's all over in about an hour. The British come out of the trench, they all get shot down, and the Germans go home and have their tea, you know, and that's it. There's nothing to talk about. But I think a more interesting example is the Battle of Loos, which you can read accounts of the Battle of Loos in the autumn of 1915 and think this is this massive British offensive. And it was the biggest battle that the British Army had fought up until then anyway. But it's only one tiny part of an immense French offensive. And it really is, you know, the diversion to the diversionary effort, actually, of in sort of in overall Allied terms. And again, so from the German point of view, it's kind of, well, we lost this mining village. The British captured this mining village in Belgium, but, you know, we can get it back anytime we get it back anytime we like. What's the fuss all about? You know, we've got a big battle, or two big battles going on against the French. And the final example I would give you, because I think it's more interesting, and I think it gets to the point of, you know, one of the themes that's run through our conversation about Anglocentrism, is the first day of the Battle of Ypres, the third Battle of Ypres, I should say, on the 31st of July, 1917. Now, from a British perspective, this is a long-awaited and huge offensive. And it's relatively successful, but it's all over in a day because the weather breaks. And then, as we know, you get stuck into a 3-month long slugfest through the Flanders mud, which does turn into, the Germans call it a Riesenring. It's a giant wrestling match. A very major battle. But if you look at the German accounts of that first day, they are broadly, the British attacked, made a little bit of ground, but we were able to contain it all well within our defensive systems. The local troops were perfectly capable of handling the situation and with their own reserves, didn't need to send them any more troops or anything like that. Pretty good day's work from a German defensive perspective. So it's a very, it shows a very different perspectives, I think, of these things. Now, okay, the Germans didn't know that the British and the French were going to carry on hammering away for another 4 months at that point, and so it didn't have that kind of significant, the same level of significance for them, perhaps, as it had for the British, who'd been planning it for months. But But nonetheless, I think what it shows is that the effects of operations of this kind are often felt by the enemy to be much less significant than they feel to those who have managed to put the operations together.
Yeah, I think that's a good note to wind up the interview, because I think that kind of encapsulates part of what readers hopefully get out of the book, or at least that I did, is this really interesting interplay of perspectives that you don't always see in some of the literature. If our listeners want to get their hands on your book, which I believe is coming out as well in paperback now, where can they best do that?
It's out in paperback. Yes, it came out in paperback in about April. So it should be available through all good bookshops, Amazon, obviously, and other online bookshops, or indeed from www.oup.com.
Oxford University Press, yeah.
It's Oxford University Press, who are the publishers, yeah. So, I really enjoyed writing it. I hope you enjoyed reading it, and I hope that many of your listeners decide that they want to read it.
I certainly did enjoy it, and I very much enjoyed speaking with you today. So I want to thank you again, Dr. Buff, for joining us, and I hope that our listeners enjoyed it as much as I did.
Super. Thank you very much indeed.
We will see you soon. As I said in the beginning, there are plenty more interviews lined up for this summer, so stay tuned. And if you enjoy this podcast, maybe also leave us a review or recommend us to a friend. Thank you.